Juliana Stratton is our new lieutenant governor, and she's been given a big role in the new Pritzker administration, tasked with leading the state's efforts to reform our criminal justice system.
What needs to happen in our community so that more people have access to opportunity? A lack of economic opportunity is often the reason why some people end up in the criminal justice system. So we have to, again, think in a very comprehensive way of not just what happens in our prison system, but what happens in our community.
Plus, Illinois struggles with a teacher shortage, especially at the pre-K level. And this is especially true when it comes to male teachers. Less than 2% are men, even less are men of color. Why it's important to have more male role models in children's lives early on as teachers. And the story of the 8-foot-tall lost vase from the 1893 Chicago World's Fair. It was found in a California seafood restaurant. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, Illinois' teacher shortage extends all the way down to the preschool level. And at that level, there's a real need, especially for more male teachers. Plus, maybe you've heard stories about the 1893 World's Fair. Here's a new one. A long-lost giant vase from that era has been found at a seafood restaurant in California. We'll bring in that story later. But first, as we wrap up our series of conversations last week and this week about the new Pritzker administration, we've been talking to different stakeholders about what they expect. Today, we're ending with criminal justice reform. Governor J.B. Pritzker has put his new lieutenant governor, Juliana Stratton, in charge of the state's efforts to overhaul the criminal justice system. They've created a new office called the Office of Criminal Justice Reform and Economic Opportunity. Later on, we'll hear from a community group in Champaign about what they hope to see from the new administration. But first, I had a chance to speak with the lieutenant governor yesterday about all of this, and I started by asking her how she planned to address the many different issues in criminal justice reform with a comprehensive strategy.
This is really exciting what the governor and I have decided to do, and we'll be forming this new Office of Criminal Justice Reform and Economic Opportunity, and actually are really looking at it more from an office of restorative justice and opportunity. And it's really designed to look at how we often look at policy issues around criminal justice reform through a singular lens, where we think about people who are in the system, what can we do to, you know, help reform the system, but we don't often tie it to one of the key policy issues that either leads people to the system or causes them to cycle through the system, and that is a lack of economic opportunity. And so in tying the opportunity piece to this, it really is looking at what can we do within communities to create more opportunities, whether that's small business opportunities or job opportunities, educational opportunities, housing, and other things that are so critical to a thriving community. How can we make sure that we provide opportunities in those areas to keep people out of the system in the first place and to ensure that when they return from our justice system back to their communities, which most people do, that there are opportunities for them there so that they don't cycle in and out of the system?
So, of course, you have different kinds of experience with the criminal justice system. Your background as a lawyer, before you were a state representative, you also directed UIC Center for Public Safety and Justice. You are well known in this field of restorative justice. And I wanted to ask, for people who don't know much about restorative justice, how should they think about your philosophy and how you're approaching this? What do they need to know?
Well, I think one of the first things that people need to know is that restorative justice is not a new idea. Restorative justice is really a way of living, and it's based on indigenous people who recognize that when it came to resolving issues in their community or their village or in their tribe, they didn't have to go outside of the people within their village to find the solutions to their problems. What we say in the world of restorative justice is the wisdom is in the room. When we build relationship with one another, when we think about how every act that I might take as a community member affects my fellow community members, then when we look at it that way, we can think about what needs to happen within our own community without going to external sources to consider how we can build our community and repair harm when harm has been done. And so I often think about when it comes to criminal justice reform, we can think of a lot of policies that have been made over the years that have caused harm to communities, and disproportionately communities of color. Having a restorative justice lens says, how can we lift up the voices of those in the community to have greater input in terms of what would work best to repair harm to that community? What are communities looking for?
And how do you see this translating to a policy level and to this office when it comes to taking input from communities? As I'm thinking about people who are listening all throughout the state, how can they get involved?
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, I think, first of all, we will continue to develop ways to make sure that civic engagement is a part of our office. And I look forward to working with community partners. But I think what's really critical is that there are good people doing great work in communities all across this state. As it relates to, for example, when we think of juvenile justice reform and thinking of how do we create a system that keeps young people from being incarcerated and out of our justice system, because we know that young people who are incarcerated at an early age are much more likely to end up in the adult system. What we have to think about is, what's happening in communities that could be replicated in other parts of our state? What is working well? What are some of the evidence-based practices? What are some of the things that are really helping to keep young people engaged in school and to recognize that, you know, it's better for them to have alternatives in the community rather than being locked up? And that's one example of something that we'll have to take a look at. But that's an example of restorative justice, because it's helping to think about, how do we not do further harm to a young person? Remember, many of the young people who end up in our justice system have experienced high levels of trauma. They've either seen too much or they've experienced too much. Sometimes they've seen violence in the home. They've seen violence in their communities. So what do we need to do for those young people that can be an alternative to incarceration? And finding ways to wrap our arms around young people to make sure that they can be on a path to success. So that's an example about how we kind of look at this issue through a restorative lens rather than a punitive lens.
I'm speaking with Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton, and I wanted to ask you about the cash bail system, because last year there was a new law in Illinois that took effect that created new protections for people who have been arrested for low-level offenses and can't afford to pay. I wonder if you think Illinois should go even further and abolish cash bail statewide like California has done?
One of the things that we know as it relates to the cash bail system is that when it comes to county jails, there are many people who linger in our jails simply because they cannot afford to bond out. There are people that if they called everybody they knew or emptied out whatever accounts they had, they would not be able to come up with very low amount as bail. So the question becomes, what is the purpose of pretrial detention? And when we look at it statutorily, the goal is to make sure that people who might be a flight risk or people who are a threat to public safety are detained. But we have a number of people who, if they had the money, they could go home. And so we want to make sure that when we look at how we can potentially reform this system, is what can we do to make sure that it is not someone's economic status that is the key to whether somebody stays in detention or not, and that instead it is focused on doing a more comprehensive assessment as to whether or not that person is a threat to public safety.
We got a listener question from our friends at the Illinois Newsroom related to marijuana and criminal justice. They did an event here in Champaign-Urbana, and one of the listeners there asked about legalizing marijuana, and that person asked, what happens to people who have already been negatively impacted by marijuana in the criminal justice system? Will they be released or will their record be cleared?
Well, that's a good question. And one of the reasons why we have focused on an Office of Justice, Equity, and Opportunity is because we want to make sure, and again, through the restorative lens, that we are repairing harm that's been done to communities, particularly communities that have been disproportionately impacted by the war on drugs. So when Governor Pritzker and I talk about the legalization of cannabis use for adults, we want to make sure that this legalization is done in an equitable way. And so there's a couple of aspects of this. One, to your listener's question, we want to make sure that individuals with misdemeanor marijuana convictions are able to get their records expunged. And we want to make sure that they can also qualify for small business loans and cannabis permits and licensing. And we also want to make sure that when we think about a cannabis equity program, that we, you know, are very intentional about promoting Black and brown entrepreneurs into the ownership and licensing of new cannabis dispensaries, because this is the way that we can help repair the harm.
One last question for you, Lieutenant Governor. When it comes to reforming criminal justice, the system, that's obviously been a bipartisan issue. I'm thinking of the previous administration. Governor Rauner also had an ambitious plan. He set up a task force to try to decrease our prison population by 25%. So currently, there's about 41,000 prisoners here in Illinois. That's down from before. I wonder what your administration, what the Pritzker administration has learned from the past 4 years, and it also will be doing differently.
Well, as a state representative, I was proud to have worked on a very bipartisan basis on a number of criminal justice reform initiatives, and was happy to work with my colleagues across the aisle. And both Governor Pritzker and I plan to work in a bipartisan fashion as we think about some of these criminal justice reform initiatives. But I think, you know, when we talk about this broad goal of how do we bring reform, there's a number of things that the governor and I have put forth. We want to talk about reentry, of course, and what happens when people leave the system, because we have a high recidivism rate in our state. So what do we need to do in communities, and how can we help people before they exit the system to be reconnected to their families and their communities so that it's a smoother transition and they'll have some roots in their community when they come out? But in addition to reentry, we have to think about no entry. And that's kind of what I talked about before. What needs to happen in our community so that more people have access to opportunity? A lack of economic opportunity is often the reason why some people end up in the criminal justice system. And when they come out of the system, there's a lack of economic opportunity that often causes them to cycle through the system. So we have to, again, think in a very comprehensive way of not just what happens in our prison system, but what happens in our communities. And then we have to think about modernizing sentencing and making sure that we're really focused on rehabilitation. So what needs to happen in terms of job training and providing people with educational opportunities and mental health services and other things that are needed even while they are still incarcerated, so that they can have a smoother transition as they are exiting the system? And then I think I would just finally say we'll have to address the issue of violence in our communities. And address it both from the standpoint of how do we reduce the flow of guns. And as you know, Governor Pritzker just signed the gun dealer licensing bill just last week. But other measures that we can do to help reduce the flow of guns and illegal guns into our community, but also to make sure that we are addressing gun violence as a public health issue and really addressing the trauma and some of the other aspects of how do we intervene into gun violence. So these are all things that we'll be looking at on a comprehensive basis. Throughout our state, there are many parts of our state, including Rockford and Peoria, East St. Louis, and of course in Chicago, where violence has been such an issue. And we want to make sure that we take a comprehensive look. And yes, we want to reduce the prison population, and that, of course, is something that we will be looking to work towards as well, but we also need to make sure that communities are strengthened. And I'll just end by saying one of the ways that we will do that is to make sure that every year we pass a budget in our state. Going 736 days without a budget had a devastating impact on many of the communities that are impacted by violence the most, and we have to make sure we bring some stabilization.
Juliana Stratton is the new Lieutenant Governor of Illinois. Thanks for making the time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
You just heard the Lieutenant Governor mention, among other things, that there are people all over the state working towards improving our criminal justice system. I'm joined now by a member of one of those organizations. Marlon Mitchell is the co-founder of First Followers. He's here with me on our studios in Urbana. First Followers is a volunteer community organization based in Champaign that supports formerly incarcerated people and their families. Hi, Marlon. Welcome to the 21st. Good morning. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I wonder, as you were just listening to the Lieutenant Governor, what your thoughts are just as you're listening to her philosophy and how they are going to be approaching things.
I think they're right on. I think they're right on, and I say that because when she talks about lifting up the voices. You know, one of the things that we always talk about is that those who are closest to the problem are closest to the solutions, right? And those sound solutions. And I always tell people, you know, we have a voice and we need to understand or be able to advocate for ourselves rather than somebody telling us what we need. We can advocate for ourselves and share with them what we actually do need.
That said, I wonder if you can, there might be, I think folks in the Champaign-Urbana, our listeners in that area, might know a little bit about First Followers, but we have people who are tuning in all throughout the state. What do you all do to support people who, as they are coming out of the system?
So we run a drop-in center, and basically what that looks like, we have drop-in hours twice a week where any individual that has been involved with the criminal justice system can come in and kind of get services. More times than not, they're looking for employment. So as we all know, with the age of technology, things move really fast and everything's digital. So we have mentors, peer mentors is what I call them, and they're volunteer-based. They just come in and they kind of assist people with assist these individuals with filling out applications online and just trying to find employment. So that's the biggest need that we see oftentimes.
How many volunteers work with you guys?
So I have about nine mentors, what we call them, volunteer mentors, and many of them have been involved with the criminal justice system at some point in their life.
We have to take a break, but when we come back, I want to hear more about why you started First Followers and ask you a little bit more about the work that you're doing and what you think, to your point about your voice, you're working directly with this, what you would like to see change when it comes to people who are returning citizens. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Marlon Mitchell. He's the co-founder of First Followers in Champaign. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Marlon Mitchell. He co-founded the community organization First Followers in Champaign. We've been talking about what they do to help formerly incarcerated individuals and what the new Pritzker administration can and should do to help reform our state's criminal justice system. Marlon, what made you want to start First Followers?
Just seeing people recycling in and out of the penitentiary. You know, I have family members. I myself have been incarcerated, so you know, just seeing this whole cycle, you know, you see someone one day and then the next day they're not there for 2, 3, 4, 5 years.
And in your experience, as people are coming out of the system, what do they need most?
Oh, they just need the opportunity. Oftentimes what happens is that social stigma that's placed on them and they've just been discarded and marginalized. I can say from my experiences, I see a lot of talent, a lot of human capital in people. And they're just wanting to give and get themselves back, you know, get their feet up under them and just be positive individuals. They all want someone. I've never sat down with anybody during a drop-in center and heard them say, I don't want anything out of life. Everybody's looking just for an opportunity.
And how much of those opportunities are economic then?
Upwards of 95%. I mean, it's very, very high. Unemployment rate for especially African-American males are 2, 3, 4 times the national average.
That's Marlon Mitchell. He's the co-founder of First Followers. We've got a caller on the line who's going to join our conversation. Bobby is on the line, I believe, from Champaign. Hi, Bobby. And you are also work with First Followers?
Yeah, I'm on the board.
And what comment? You had a comment you wanted to make as well.
The thing that I've worked most closely with, not just with First Followers, but other people, is helping people get IDs when they come out of prison or when they have a transition. And it's almost impossible. And one of the biggest stumbling blocks is that the Department of Motor Vehicles does not recognize a state or prison ID. Now, who knows better who you are than the prison or jail that you've been in? And if it's, you know, if your personal ID is over a year out of date, then that, or license, that is not valid. And it is almost impossible to get a form of ID that the DMV will recognize to issue you a state ID. And if you don't have an ID, you can't do nothing. You're blocked at every turn.
So a prison ID is not a valid form of identification for you to swap that into the DMV into getting a driver's license.
That's my understanding, yeah.
And I imagine just things like that. Bobby, thanks for your call. I appreciate it. Marlon, those are things that this seems like a little thing, but actually is a really big issue if you don't have a form of identification.
Yeah, it's a major issue. And I say that because oftentimes when people are incarcerated, they're away for a while. And when you come home, a lot of times people have moved, things have been shuffled around, and you can't get your ID. As Ms. Bobby said, after a year, that's not recognized. So what happens is you have to go back and get all these documents and pull all these documents together. And oftentimes people don't have those documents.
And then I wonder how expensive it is, too. Is it more expensive also?
Well, yeah. So actually down at First Followers, in our drop-in center, that's one of the things that we do is we just start from square one. And what that looks like is maybe just sit down and ask, hey, okay, we need to get you a birth certificate. So we have to track that down. Then you get a birth certificate, and then you take the birth certificate and get a social security card. So there's a cost involved with all of that. There's a lot of time involved with all of that, a lot of research and going back to square one, trying to figure all that out. Just to get the ID, and it takes time.
And when you think about other challenges, what would you say are other maybe things that people might take for granted that are really big hurdles that people need to overcome?
It's just that thing about social stigma and people being ostracized. Whether they have been found guilty or not, or being incarcerated for things that they didn't do, you're always going to wear that social stigma. So just getting the public to understand that just because, you know, I might have run afoul of the law or, you know, made mistakes in my youth or whatever that might have been, no sound decision making, I just made a mistake. And just getting people to understand that everyone deserves a second chance. And, you know, kind of wiping that slate clean because you've paid your debt to society and you just want a fresh start.
Marlon, all this week and last week, we've been having conversations about all these different issues facing the new Pritzker administration. This is the last one we're having, but we've talked about education and the economy. We've talked about marijuana legalization yesterday, like lots of different issues. And as we end here, I think there's so many things that compete for a governor's attention, especially when they first take office. I wonder what you want government officials to know about the work that you do at First Followers, about the work that you're doing?
They have to invest in the community. A lot of human capital has been taken out of those communities that they're going to need an investment. And this economic opportunity piece that the lieutenant governor is talking about is a sound start. And what that looks like is because you have to train people up. You have to instill some hope after a while, because once a stigma has been placed on you, you kind of lose that self-worth. It's a very, very fundamental. And I say that because I deal with the population every day. And you just have to start there with hope. But you also have to have, from the government standpoint, reinvesting in those communities and setting up different economic opportunities. So I think she's right about that. And I like the direction that the new government is going. But the only thing to draw back with that is that it has to, and she mentioned this, it has to come from the community. You have to understand what the community needs. Not every community is the same. And what we do sometimes with these social work models is that, you know, you paint everything with a broad brush, and that paradigm needs to shift, needs to change. Everything needs to be individualized. And going into the community and understanding and talking to the people who have been directly impacted and directly affected, they know better than anybody else.
And you think that's true also for different communities across Illinois
as
well?
That's true. That's very true.
That's Marlon Mitchell. He's the co-founder of First Followers, located at Bethel AME Church in Champaign. Marlon, thanks for taking the time to be with me. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate it, Niall.
If you tuned in earlier this week on Tuesday, you heard educators talk about what they wanted from a new administration in Illinois. And one thing they all agreed on was the importance of early childhood education. But there's a shortage of teachers around the state. One solution, suggests Chalkbeat reporter Cassie Walker-Burke, is men, especially men of color. As it stands now, men account for less than 2% of licensed teachers in certified child care centers. That's according to a 2017 report from the Illinois Network of Child Care Resource Referral Agencies. And if you've had a kid in preschool lately, this is probably not a surprise to you. Think of the last time you saw a man in the classroom, or even more rare, a man of color. As I said, Cassie Burke wrote about this for Chalkbeat Chicago, where she's the bureau chief, and she's on the line with me. She's on the line now with me from there. Hi, Cassie. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We also wanted to invite some educators to join this conversation. Lee Tate is one of those rare male teachers at an early childhood center in Hyde Park called Chicago Child Care Society. Janera Walters is a superintendent of District 111 in Kankakee, and this is an issue she's been working on as superintendent. Both of you, welcome as well. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Cassie, I wanted to just start by asking, as we hear, we've heard so much about how underfunded schools have been, public schools have been in the state, a teacher shortage across grade levels. What does that look like when it comes to early childhood education?
When we talk about a teacher shortage on the K-12 side, you see pockets, right? You see certain profession, like bilingual teachers or special education teachers, certain districts are hit harder than others. But pre-K and preschool and early childhood see the teacher shortage pretty much across the board. And here's one really telling statistic. So the State Board of Education in 2012 issued about 1,300 licenses to new teachers with early childhood endorsements. By 2017, that number had dropped in half. That's half. And we're talking about at a time when the state is actually trying to push for more quality programs, and that means for teachers, it means more credentialing. So we have half of the people entering the workforce. At the same time, we know we're pushing in Chicago for universal pre-K, and that's something that's also been on Governor Pritzker's agenda for down the road, is universal pre-K statewide.
Superintendent Walters, I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about what your district looks like, as well as what it looks like for you when it comes to hiring teachers.
We're a diverse district. We're a high minority, high poverty, approximately 48% African-American, 30% Latino, 20% white, and 2% multicultural. In terms of the diversity in our preschool program, we have about 600 students in preschool, and the diversity within the preschool program mirrors our K-12 population. In terms of the teacher shortage, we're having challenges across grade levels. We're not having as many challenges in preschool only because for preschool educators, we're probably the highest paid preschool employer in our immediate area. So that actually has helped us in preschool, but our issue is K-12 also, and we believe that preschool goes up to third grade. So you see a major issue with kindergarten, first, second, and third grade teachers, particularly men and particularly men of color.
And Superintendent Walters, at what grade level do you tend to see male teachers? Is it not, obviously, I think it's kind of unusual to see male teachers that are in lower grades or pre-K?
Yeah, so it's interesting. We have one male teacher preschool, 8 kindergarten through 3rd, 4th through 6th, 13, 7th through 8th, which is our junior high, 13. At our 9th through 12th grade, our high school, we have 42 male teachers.
Why do you think that is?
You know, I think the perception of society in general that that women are more caregivers, and that in preschool and in early childhood, when you go up to third grade, you have more caregivers at that level. Whereas as the students get older, they stop perceiving them as children, which I think is inappropriate also, and that high school students are seen as more adult-like. I think that's a fallacy. I think that children, they grow and they develop differently, but in terms of access to male role models, they need that across the board from preschool all the way through high school.
That's Superintendent Walters. She's the superintendent of School District 111 in Kankakee. Lee Tate's also with us from Chicago. He is a teacher at Chicago Child Care Society on the South Side in Hyde Park. Lee, as we've been talking about how rare it is for men, especially men of color, to pursue careers in early childhood education, I wonder if you could share your story. What made you want to become a teacher?
Well, as a child growing up in CPS, I had a lot of male teachers of color and not of color, and they really took a great interest in my education and helped me develop the potential that I had. So I want to give back to children who need the same types of support and guidance. So I really had great teachers growing up, so it was really just a pleasure to return to the field and help others to get what I had.
What was so great about them? What do you remember about that in particular, about especially the male teachers?
Well, tapping early on into my interest. Like, for instance, I had a teacher who really helped me to see that I love to write and I love to, do poetry and things like that. And he really, my English teacher, really just pushed me. He said, you know what? I see the potential you have. I really think that you need to work on this and develop this. So he met with me outside of school, you know. So it's kind of like he took us places. My classmates and I, like, took us places outside of school. So he was really dedicated to what he did as a teacher, and it really made me feel like, wow, you know, this guy is really helping me to see what I can do and helping me to understand my passion and helping me to pool all of my passion and my dreams to figure out what I need to do with my life. So he helped me. So he really just, like, it was just outside of school, in school, and things like that. So it was like dedication, going the extra mile to help us realize our potential. So,
right. Yeah, I think all of us can remember those teachers, especially when we are younger, right? So Superintendent Walters was talking about the conceptions and maybe their stereotypes about teachers, especially at a younger level and being child caregivers. And I wonder, I want you to speak from your personal experience here and what you think your identity brings that's maybe different to your teaching style.
Well, you know, eventually what happens is when I first started working with small children, a lot of the parents were looking like, who is this guy? You know, so they do, because they don't see a lot of men in classrooms with small children. They're like, what's bringing him here? Like, what's his motive? So a lot of the parents will, you know, pull me to the side and talk to me and ask me why I got into the field. And what I've noticed that most fathers are sticking around to see what I'm doing and asking me for guidance and things to do with their children at home. So it kind of makes them interested in what's going on and why I'm doing what I do. So I've been able to talk to a lot of parents, a lot of fathers in particular, to get them to see what their children are doing and to how they can help their children, and kind of helping them to get, like, interested in becoming more active in this field and maybe volunteering and eventually deciding whether they want to do what I'm doing. So it's kind of like twofold. You know, I'm working with the children, but the families are also interested in what I'm doing because I'm a male and they don't see many males in this field. So,
yeah, thanks for sharing that, Lee. Cassie, with your reporting with Chalkbeat, did you also hear these sentiments as you've been reporting out this issue?
I did. I think that, you know, one thing I found really interesting, well, first I would say that, you know, research shows a boost in attendance and test scores when children have teachers that look like them. And when we step back and think that we are modeling for children, in the state of Illinois, 80% of our teachers are white. Think about what kind of message that sends to students. Only half of our student body in Illinois is white. The other thing I would say is I think this is an interesting time that we have a shift in the mindset of what preschool should be. I think we used to think of it as play, and that women should do the play, moms should do the play. But now we're seeing school districts offering formal 4-year-old and 3-year-old classrooms. We're seeing quality standards across the community providers. And I think that we're starting to shift about what happens in those classrooms and who should be there. When I was talking to other men who were interested in entering this field, they talked about being in classrooms where they were the only man. These are their teacher prep classrooms, and they were the only man, and, like, what kind of message that sent. I think there's also the issue of pay in this field. This field is notoriously low paid. The school districts can pay more than the community providers oftentimes, but I think if we want to have more men and want to have more people, period, entering this field, we have to really look at the issue of pay and what we're willing to pay these teachers who are credentialed in many cases.
Yeah. We have to take a break here, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Cassie, with Lee, and with Superintendent Walters. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about the need for more men in early childhood education. Right now, they make up less than 2% of the preschool teacher workforce at a time when there aren't enough teachers in general. My guests are Gennaro Walters, superintendent of Kankakee School District 111, Lee Tate, who's a teacher at the Chicago Child Care Society in Hyde Park, and Cassie Walker-Burke, who's the bureau chief at Chalkbeat Chicago, and she first reported the story for them. We'll tweet out that piece for anyone who's interested in reading more about this. Cassie, I wanted to just get to that pay gap issue and ask you about how big that issue is when we're thinking about not just preschool teachers, but the case with daycare. How much, what the median hourly wage looks like, and how much you think that would make a difference when it comes to recruiting more people, not just men, but women into this field?
So the median hourly wage and this is across centers in Illinois, and this is according to a 2017 report, was $12.50 an hour. Now, of course, it goes up a little bit for credentialed teachers, but not significantly. And importantly, it also goes down to between $8.50 and $10.50, depending on what region of the state you're in and different minimum wage requirements for assistants in the classrooms. And so I think that you're seeing a lot of school systems, such as Chicago Public Schools, they're starting to open preschool classrooms. Now, the pay there is different. Those teachers are unionized in Chicago, and those teachers are on the CPS scale. But half of our preschool classrooms in the city are still based in community centers, and that's true throughout the state. It's a mixed delivery system. And so the pay gap is really a big issue moving forward. And I think that until, and you hear advocates say it all the time, until we really wrestle with this issue in Illinois, we're going to have a hard time filling these classrooms with quality staff.
Superintendent Walters, I imagine pay is probably one of your biggest issues when it comes to recruitment, especially even though you, as you said, you're actually paying more than a lot of community centers are in Kankakee.
Yes. Yeah, so K through 12, it is more of an issue because then we're competing statewide. But in terms of preschool teachers, because we are a school district, we are able to pay more than the local preschool programs, particularly community-based programs. We're not having as much of a struggle. But the problem with that, though, is that there's a little bit of a resentment because you'll have a preschool teacher start in one program, and because of the pay, they would move to the school district. And we also don't want that to happen either, because all of the programs are important to our community.
Mm-hmm. Lee, how much is salary an issue for folks when you're talking to colleagues about this?
Well, we're fortunate enough to have the same situation that you just mentioned. Our program is one of the highest paid programs here, so it's like we don't have a lot of a big issue with that at all. We don't really discuss that, but it's like that's not an issue here. So,
well, that's a good recruitment tool for you too,
exactly.
Right? Cassie, I wanted to just ask you about some solutions to this, and you wrote about a program called Men of Color. Can you tell us about that? That's in conjunction with the City Colleges in Chicago.
Sure. So this is a program that was started by a former CPS principal who's now the president of Truman College, a man by the name of Sean Jackson. And he has worked with his staff at Truman and worked with the leadership at CPS to build this pipeline program. It's just in its pilot phase. I think there's only 33 students that are currently signed up. And so what it would do is help recruit young men, men of color, to go through the City College system and get their two-year certification to teach in early childhood centers. And that would then set somebody up if they want to go on and get a four-year full teaching credential or if they want to be an assistant in a classroom. But that would help start building this pipeline and really focus it toward men. And one of the things they're doing that I think is really interesting is that he's brought on 15 mentors who are either male teachers or male principals of color within Chicago public schools to help mentor these guys, to help be there, answer questions, to help just kind of give them that little nudge when they need it. And I think that's a really important aspect of this program. Another thing they're doing is partnering with Chicago Public Schools so that actually students can start the summer before their senior year taking classes at city colleges in this field, and then they get dual credit. So they get credit within CPS and they get credit within city colleges. So it just helps them, you know, it helps build that ramp toward a degree faster.
Lee, as we end here, I wonder what else you want people to know about encouraging more men, why you think it's important for more men to be in the field of early childhood education.
I think that if people really let these men know how much of an impact they would have in these classrooms, I think they would be a little easier swayed. Because if they really came into classrooms and to see what happens in there, they would really be they want to be more involved. Like, the children just treat you like a rock star. You come in and every morning, "Hey, Mr. Tate," they all come running to you. It's like an ego boost, but it's really just so much being done, and you have a lasting impact on them. So if they knew that, I think they would be a little bit easier swayed to come into the classroom with children.
Well, thank you, Mr. Tate, for sharing how fulfilling your career has been. That's Lee Tate, who teaches at Chicago Child Care Society. I want to thank Superintendent Walters with School District 111 in Kankakee, and Cassie Walker-Burke, who's the Bureau Chief of Chalk Beach Chicago and who has been writing about this issue. All of you, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Not much that remains from the 1893 World's Columbian Exposition in Chicago. We have the Museum of Science and Industry, and we have some artifacts, many at the Field Museum, actually. More than 27 million people attended the exposition during its six-month run, and some of those people would have passed by a set of three huge Japanese ceramic pieces on display. They were made especially for the fair by Japanese artists. Two of those pieces are at Oxford University, but for years, the location of the third, a vase, remained a mystery. But now it's been found, not in a private collection or a museum, instead at a seafood restaurant in Berkeley, California. Alicia Spenger's family started Spenger's Fish Grotto back in 1890, and she's on the line with me now from Berkeley to tell us more of her story. Derek Torres is also with us from the Clark's Auction Gallery in Oakland, California. Alicia, Derek, thanks for being here. Welcome to the 21st.
Oh, thank you for having me on your show.
Alicia, before we get to the vase, I wonder if you can tell us about the history of your family's restaurant.
Well, my great-grandfather started Spenger's Fish Grotto in 1890 in Berkeley, California. And it was a large restaurant the size of a city block, which had a fresh market where you could come in daily and buy fresh food, fresh fish, a food to go that you could go into and get food and leave with it or go into the Diamond Bar and eat it.
And the Diamond Bar, can I just ask you about that? Because I imagine the Diamond Bar, you guys, there were a lot of historical artifacts at your family's restaurant. A 34-carat diamond, that's real, right?
Yes, it is.
And your guys actually used to have the front end of the USS Indiana in your parking lot. How did your family's fish grotto wind up with having so many different artifacts in their restaurant?
Well, my great-grandfather was quite the collector, and being there near San Francisco in the Richmond area over there, lots of the boats would come in, and either he would go down there and be a big collector and take the items, or people would bring them to him. I'm not sure about the USS Indiana, how it ended up there in the parking lot, but it was there for many years.
And what did you hear from your family, from your dad and your grandfather, about how this vase ended up at Spenger's?
You know, we don't really know how it ended up there. I just know that it was my great-grandfather obtained it, and he put it up, and they lived above the restaurant in a penthouse, him and my great-grandmother. And my great-grandmother came home one day and came in, and it was in there. And she was like, "What is that?" Because it's so large. With the base and crown, it's 8 feet tall. And basically, she was like, "That's just way too big to have it down here. Put that down in the restaurant."
Derek, how did you, I wonder, before we get to how you found out about the vase, can you describe what it looks like for our listeners?
Yeah, it's about 8 feet tall with the crown and the base. The base is made of 200-year-old wood. It has a front and a back. The front has like a large dragon, kind of an angry dragon with yellow, greens, and grays over a big kind of wild ocean. And on the sides, there are these chrysanthemum flower handles with ribbons hanging down with light greens and blues. And then on the back is a dark moon over a sky with these birds. I think they're called Japanese night herons. And I think the chrysanthemums represent something to do with either the Japanese or the Chinese. I'm not exactly
Derek,
sure.
Derek, do you know? Yeah.
It's actually an imperial. So the chrysanthemum is an imperial, basically an imperial mark for the Japanese. So it's, and we have to also think that the emperor had to approve of these before they were shipped out to Chicago. So there's a lot of pride in Japanese culture sending these to Chicago for the
exposition. So, Derek,
and just to clarify,
go ahead.
Just to clarify, they're cloisonné, which is a really difficult medium to work in. So it's basically enamel over copper, and it looks like a painting, but it's such a hard medium to work in. And at the time, this triptych was the largest ever produced.
So what was it like for you, Derek, when you realized that this was actually this vase from the World's Fair in 1893?
A feeling of total adrenaline once my research took me there. And I was really proud. You know, I mean, I went to the restaurant as a child, never really paid too much attention to that. I thought the ring was fake as a cynical little boy. But the vase, until I was older, then I could appreciate its beauty. But as a child, I just really didn't even see it. And the research started with two scholars from San Francisco State University, Dr. Marvin Nathan and Dr. Roger Burt. And they both wrote a book on the 1894 Midwinter Fair in San Francisco. And they said this was exhibited at the 1894 Fair and possibly at Chicago, but they had no definitive proof that they could share with me.
And then how did
that's
you
from my research?
Right. How did you figure it out that it was actually from the World's Fair?
I have a lot of publications of the fair that aren't online. And so that was my first step, was to look at in my reference library to see if, in fact, it was written about in the books I have. And it was. And that led me then to Judith Snodgrass, who wrote a paper on the triptych. I want to say 2006 it was reproduced. So I reached out to her and told her, I think I have the missing vase. And she said, well, if it has a dragon and, you know, the night sky and the verso, you probably do. I sent her pictures and she couldn't believe it. And the vase we'll be offering is the only one with the original crown and the original base. The other vase, both of those pieces are lost.
So now this is going up for auction in a couple of weeks, Derek, because the restaurant is closed, right? And so because of that, I know you can't say for sure how much you think it will go for, but what is it valued at, a vase like this?
It's conservative. There are condition issues, but the historical value supersedes the condition issues. The estimate is $30,000 to $50,000 because there are no comparables, and the other two are in institutions. So it'll be $30,000 to $50,000 starting at $15,000. And the diamond ring is going to be $400,000 to $600,000 with a very positive upside.
Wow. So, Alicia, where do you hope the vase ends up? I know it's an auction, so you don't get to choose, but do you have a hope?
Well, I mean, my thought of all of these items, especially the ring and the vase, that they end up with someone who has meaning to, you know, behind it, or, you know, with the other ones. And, you know, I just really hope that they go to someone who's really passionate about collecting, as my great-grandfather was, and that's how, you know, why he wanted it.
Right, especially with the restaurant closing. I know you, it would, I wonder, yeah. Do you think it should come back to Chicago, Alicia?
Sure. I mean, whoever, yeah, that's great. Yeah.
Anyone who has a spare $50,000 in Chicago.
$50,000, that's great.
Derek, have you been contacted by anyone in Chicago?
I've been contacted by representatives. I don't know who they're representing. But yes, it's gotten a lot of attention from different institutions, which makes me really happy, you know, and I think that it was made to be seen in a public venue, and it was the pride of Japan, and it should be on display for countless others to see. And on a side note, the ring has ties to Hawaiian royalty. and we found that out late last night.
Wow.
So it has ties to Queen Liliuokalani.
So we will tweet out, actually, the Chicago Tribune first wrote about this, so we're going to tweet out their article that has more about this story. But I want to thank Derek Torres for being with us, as well as Alicia Spenger. Thanks, you guys. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That does it for us for this week. On Monday, we'll be talking about how some of Central Illinois' biggest cities, like Peoria and Springfield, are among the most segregated in the entire country. We will learn the story of how and why they have turned out this way. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. Our website, 21stshow.org, that's 21stshow.org, is where you can go to get more information about us. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.